I'd like you to imagine a man. He is a man on a mission. He has work to do. He's dedicated to that work. He rises sometimes very early in the morning to start his work, and sometimes he's still at it very late in the evening. He has a singleness of mind that is hard to duplicate. You don't see it very often, if ever. We might call him a road warrior, someone who travels for work. His work takes him all over the country. He travels sometimes long distances just for a day and travels back. Sometimes he's gone for weeks at a time doing his job without a break, just keeps at it. Day after day, he does his job. I think employers would love this guy. The singleness of mind keeps him focused, keeps him on track, keeps him getting the work done. Interestingly, he's also tasked with training a team that will be doing the same kind of work after he's gone. He and his trainees are together most of the time. He's rarely without the burden of his job. You're probably way ahead of me knowing who this man is. Certainly, he isn't an ordinary man. An ordinary man couldn't do what he did and what he continues to do. I retired in January after 42 years or so in the workforce. This man is yet to retire. He's been on the job for 2,000 plus years, doing the work, training others to do the work with him. Of course, man isn't a very good description of him, is it? This is Jesus Christ we're talking about, and a better description would be Savior and King. So we need to get that straight. When he was on this earth, he was on a mission to preach the gospel of the kingdom, to prepare those called by God to take up the commission, from those early disciples to the last of us working before his return and beyond. He never rests. He never takes a day off. During his ministry, there were times when Jesus became tired of the crush, the physical crush of people, let alone the mental, the workload that he had, but just the crush of people, the multitudes. And once in a while, he would slip away for some rest. But those times were rare. Didn't happen very often. Mostly, he just kept working. Today, we're going to take a close look at just one day. One day in the life of Jesus Christ. I want to take an in-depth look one day during his 3.5-year ministry. And from that, we can extrapolate what the other days may have been, must have been, likely were like. An in-depth look at one day. When we see what one day entailed, I think we can better appreciate what he did, what he endured during his time on earth. We actually, we're going to cheat a little bit. We're going to start with the evening before our day of focus. We're going to start with what happened there. He had just finished speaking parables to a great multitude. So great, he had retreated onto the sea in a boat so that the crush of people wouldn't push him into the sea. So he was speaking to them from a boat. He was likely exhausted. Let's go to Mark 4. We'll start in verses 35 through 38. We'll spend most of our time in Mark 4 today, Mark 4 and 5 and on. So start in Mark 4, verses 35 through 38. Mark 4, verse 35. On the same day, so this was the day that he had been speaking those parables, and it was getting late. On the same day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." So he was on the Sea of Galilee on the western bank, crossing over to the eastern bank. Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. So likely the disciples, at least the 12, and maybe more, were with him as they travel across the lake, starting out in the evening. 37, and a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow, and they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" So during the night, Jesus, exhausted from his day's efforts, fell asleep in the boat as they made their way toward the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, even sleeping through a violent storm. So you can imagine how exhausted he was. He fell asleep. He was sleeping through this storm. So we continue in verse 39. So the disciples have just said, "Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?" Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Now, these people have been with Jesus a while. They've seen miracles before. They've seen him heal people. Some of them were there when he turned water into wine. This wasn't their first night hanging out with Jesus. But this astonished them. Who is this man? Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? Our day in the life of Jesus begins very late at night or very early in the morning with that question. Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? They knew he was the Messiah, but to them, the Messiah was someone who was going to come and free them from the Romans, set up a physical kingdom. They were expecting that. They were expecting a different kind of power. This spiritual power was still shocking to them. Let's continue on with our day in Mark 5, starting in verse 1. Then they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains. I'm guessing their chains weren't as good as ours, but a person that couldn't be held with chains of any kind had to be just a wild man. Verse 4, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. I'd like to read a little bit of that account from Luke. You don't need to turn there, but Luke 8:27 gives us a little more of the picture. It says, and when he stepped out onto the land, there met him a certain man from the city who had demons for a long time. He wore no clothes, nor did he live in a house, but in the tombs. So they've come across the Sea of Galilee through the night. They get there in the morning, and this was the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. This was Gentile country. Jesus steps off the boat, and a filthy, naked Gentile man approaches him. There's, by the way, no indication that the disciples ever got off the boat. And I can understand that. This was not something a Jew wanted to be around. They had a different set of standards. They didn't like Gentiles, first of all, and they didn't appreciate filth or nakedness. So, you know, maybe if I was there, I'd have stayed on the boat too. But Jesus stepped off the boat. This man approached them. But these things were shameful to the Jews, so they really wanted no part of it. The disciples would not have been comfortable with it. You can almost picture their faces looking a bit aghast that Jesus would get off the boat and approach this filthy, naked Gentile man. We continue in Mark 5, verse 6. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him, and he cried out with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me." Obviously, the demons talking through this man. For he said to him, Jesus, said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." I got ahead of myself. So they arrive, this man approaches, and Jesus says, you unclean spirit, you need to come out. Jesus was handling the situation. In fact, it was the reason he came across the sea that night. Okay, continuing in verse 8, he said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." Then he asked him, "What is your name?" Asking the unclean spirit, "What is your name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Also, he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Now, a large herd of swine, we've all seen, read this story, a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, "Send us into the swine that we may enter them." It's kind of a short-term stay, though. And verse 13, "At once Jesus gave them permission, then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000. And the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea." 2,000 pigs. In that area, of course, pigs were eaten, but also sacrificed to the local gods, the local idols. The Gentile herdsmen had just lost their livelihood. We continue in verse 14. "So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see what it was that had happened. Then they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were joyful." They were afraid, because the things you don't understand are maybe worse than the things you do, and new things are strange. So they were afraid because he had cast these demons out and healed this man. "And those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. Then they began to plead with him to depart from their region." Whatever it is you've got, we don't want any more of it. Maybe they were really into their pigs, but strange situation there in that day. Nothing worse than the unknown. Here was a man who was so violent that chains couldn't contain him, shackles wouldn't hold him. But when he was healed, they asked his healer to please leave. We'd like you to go. We don't understand you. So his work was done there. Jesus turned to leave. He still had a big day ahead of him. So we'll continue on with the story. Verse 18, "And when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him, that he might go with him along. And Jesus said in verse 19, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, 'Go home to your friends, tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you.'" So Jesus told him, "No, you can't come across with me. You stay here on this side of the sea. Go tell your friends and family what happened here." And they turned the boat around and they headed back across the sea. Again, no evidence that the disciples ever got out of the boat. Just, you know, this is an ugly situation. You got it. And he did, of course. So this was what he had crossed over to do. He got back in the boat, turned around, headed back across. So we continue in Mark 5, verse 21. "Now when Jesus had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea." So that multitude that he had escaped from were still there, waiting for him to come back. They were enamored. They wanted to see more or hear more. In verse 22, "And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, 'My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed and that she will live.' So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him." So they crossed back over the Sea of Galilee, likely back to Capernaum. It's believed that this is Capernaum because of two things. First, he was known wherever this was. I mean, even the head of the synagogue knew who Jesus was. He had spoken in the synagogue in Capernaum. So that's one reason we think it was Capernaum. He had lived there off and on. He had performed many miracles there, so many, in fact, that later he cursed Capernaum because more people weren't converted from there. And they had so much given to them, so much shown to them. But this Jairus knew him and knew he could heal his daughter And it doesn't matter what your political situation is, if your daughter's sick and there's a man here who has the power to heal her, you don't care. So he begged him to come and heal his little girl. The other reason we think this is Capernaum, we'll discuss later. It's a little bit of a lengthy discussion. I do find it interesting that he is looked down upon by the Pharisees and others, but even the ruler of the synagogue is willing to fall at his feet and beg him when he needs something. They know there's more to Jesus than meets the eye. And there was a lot to him that met the eye, the miracles that they had seen. But you know, sometimes to get the miracle, to see the miracle, you had to listen to the message, to the gospel. And that's the part they disagreed with. That's the part they didn't want. So now he's headed across town to this man's home where his daughter lies sick. We continue in verse 25, Mark 5. Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up. She felt it in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, verse 30, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" I love this part, verse 31. But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude that are thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?' Everybody's touching you. It's a throng. They're bouncing off of you." I think maybe they were exhausted as well. You know, of course, they're the ones that had to row back and forth or sail, or whatever they had to do all night. Huh? But yeah, he says, "Who touched my clothes? What's going on?" We see from this description that once again, he's just surrounded by this multitude of people. He got very little rest, truly, at least on this side of the sea. And the people who knew who he was knew that he could heal and perform other miracles. And whether or not they believed what he said, they believed in what he could do. They wanted to see what he could do. That's why this multitude was following. They said, "Oh, he's heading up to the priest's place. Let's see if he can do it. Let's see what he can do. Let's see if he's able to heal the little girl." And in the meantime, one of them touched his clothes. This multitude met him at the water, followed him up into the city toward the priest's house, and they were on their way jostling along when this woman touched his garment. And his disciples, his trainees, didn't seem as calm about it as Jesus did. And who can blame them? They've had a long night, and they're thronged with the multitude again. They'd sailed across, rowed back, and their response to his question illustrated their state of mind. "What do you mean, who touched me? What do you mean, who touched you? You're surrounded, everyone." But Jesus calmly got to the bottom of the situation. Back to Mark 5, verse 32. He looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Now here's another example of the compassion and kindness of Jesus Christ. I mean, he just sailed clear across the sea, which I think is about 8 miles wide, but probably, you know, takes a while in a small sailboat or rowing. He just sailed across the sea to cast demons out of a man he didn't even know, a Gentile at that, all the way back. And now he's on a mission to this man's house, but stops, tells this woman, "Your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." An illustration of his kindness, his compassion, after an exhausting day, the day before, after not a lot of rest during the night, a crazy series of events on the other side of the lake, and then being hustled up into town by all these people, this large crowd, he stopped, he took a breath, and he showed kindness and love to this woman who was healed just by being able to touch his clothes. I can't say that I would have that kind of patience in that situation. It doesn't appear that his disciples at the time would have had that kind of patience, but he did. And the day continues. Verse 35. While he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." You need to believe. Picture the hush coming over the crowd. The girl that they were hustling up to has died. What will he do? If he had hurried more, maybe he could have saved her. If he hadn't stopped to talk to this woman, maybe he would have made it. He may have saved her. And there's the father there with him, beginning to realize what has happened. And if I know fathers, was probably on the verge of a total breakdown, total meltdown, when he heard that his baby girl, his little girl, was gone, had died. And Jesus looked him in the eye and said, "Do not be afraid, only believe." Again, compassion, kindness, love towards someone who probably didn't really agree with a lot that Jesus said. Do not be afraid, only believe. Here was this leader of the synagogue desperately, desperately wanting to believe. To believe this rabbi, this teacher who was coming to his house. You can picture the scene. And here, recorded for us, is that compassion once again of Jesus Christ to say, it's going to be okay. Just believe. Do we think that he doesn't know our trials and our pain? Here was someone that was the leader of a synagogue, came to him just because he thought, last resort, maybe Jesus can save my daughter. Do you think that Jesus doesn't know our trials and our pain? Do you think that he's not paying attention to our lives? He knows us by name, and he has love and compassion for each one of us. He is more dedicated to us, I would dare say, than we are to him. Because these are strangers that he doesn't know. He knows us. He knows us. He's got that kind of compassion and love for us as he guides us as an older brother through our lives, through our trials, and through our challenges. We continue in verse 37 of Mark 5. And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him. But when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. Of course they ridiculed him. These are people, they've seen life and death before. They knew this child was dead. They had no belief that Jesus could do anything about it. Even if they thought he might be able to heal her, it's too late. And he said, "She's just sleeping." That probably was kind of fun to say. "She's just sleeping." And then he threw everybody out and he took her parents in. And they thought, we know what death looks like, but Jesus had other plans. Verse 41. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumi," which is translated, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement. A big, big understatement there. They were overcome with great amazement. But he commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and said that something should be given to her to eat. please go ahead and get the resurrected child something to eat. She's probably hungry. Compassion and kindness and care and love for these people, all of them. Even the little girl who had died, she might be hungry. What an amazing example he was beyond the miracles. The miracles are amazing. You know, rise up and walk, take your bed and walk. That's amazing. How do bones come together and a person who hasn't walked in years or maybe their whole life gets up and walks? A child that's dead, you parents, put yourself in that place. And he compassionately takes care of the child and says, we should get her something to eat. Now, earlier I told you this was likely the city of Capernaum, and I said there were two reasons why we think that. The first one was that he was so well known in this town. They knew, hey, he's coming, and the leader of the synagogue was there. They, you know, they hustled him up the hill or wherever it was that the house was. So he had spoken at the synagogue. We would assume that they would be familiar with him. Also, the multitude knew him. So he had been there a lot. He had been teaching there a lot. That's the first reason we think it's Capernaum. Now we come to the second reason, that it was likely Capernaum. He told them not to tell anyone what had happened. Well, what does that mean? What difference does that mean? We've heard various reasons why on occasion Jesus would tell people and, you know, don't say anything. You know, the lepers, he healed 10 lepers or something, and they all ran off to, and one of them came back, but he had said, you know, don't tell them what happened, just go show yourself to the priest. So off and on, he tells people to don't say anything about what happened here. So we've heard various reasons why that he would tell people who were healed not to to say anything, to remain quiet, with various luck, because most of them said something anyway and went off. But we just read about a man on the other side of the lake, Sea of Galilee. After he cast out demons, he says, go tell everybody, go tell your friends and your family what happened here. What's the difference? Why on the east coast of the lake can you say one thing, and on the west coast of the lake you say something else? That's why we think this is Capernaum. Here, the leader of the synagogue's daughter is raised from the dead, and he says, keep this quiet. Why? What's the difference? Well, like they say in real estate, location, location, location. Jesus spent a lot of time in Capernaum and the area on the northern and western coast of the Sea of Galilee. But why? Because it was the internet. And that sounds really strange, but we know what the internet is. You know, early on it was called the information superhighway. That's what ran through Capernaum. We call it the information superhighway. Capernaum and the area along the Sea of Galilee were on the information superhighway of the day. Through this area ran what they called the Via Maris, or the coastal highway. And this was the main road, the main trading road, the main road from Cairo to Damascus in what is now modern-day Syria. It was the main trading route for the country. Remember the Roman centurion? We'll go there just real quickly. The Roman centurion who asked Jesus to come and heal his servant, that was in Capernaum. Let's go there. Matthew 8, verses 5 through 7. Quick sidetrack. We'll be back to Mark. Matthew 8, verses 5 through 7 says, now when Jesus entered Capernaum, okay, he was there. We know this is there because it identifies it. A centurion came to him pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. And the centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. And guess what? He was. Okay, so what does that have to do with our, you know, reasoning that this other event happened in Capernaum? Well, why would there be a Roman legion with a Roman centurion in Capernaum? because of this road. They had to protect the road. They had to protect the commerce that traveled the road. So all up and down that road were places with Roman legions where they stayed to protect. So that's the other reason why we think this was Capernaum, because there was a Roman garrison there, because they were protecting the Via Maris, the trade route, the superhighway of the time that passed right through Capernaum and came down to Capernaum and then went further. So if he was on the coast of the sea and all this stuff was happening, it likely was the city of Capernaum. The road was protected by the army. No other reason for there to be an army in such a small place. So the next obvious question is, why did Jesus want to be near this road, this information superhighway? Because people traveled that road. People were constantly up and down. They wanted to hear the news. They wanted to hear the latest information. They wanted to know what's going on. There have been stories and movies about the Old West here the last few years where people came together when a traveler came through town and they would say, well, what's going on in the big wide world out there? And this is what was happening here. His teachings, if he taught and healed in Capernaum, the word would spread along this information highway, the latest information. So his teachings would be talked about, word would spread across the region. There was a method to it all, and that was likely what was happening and why he spent so much time there. Okay, so back to our second reason that this day in the life ended up in Capernaum. He told the ruler of the synagogue not to tell anyone what happened with the healing of his daughter when he raised her from the dead. Now, he wasn't shy. He had told the man across the sea to tell everyone. Tell them what you saw here. No, there was another reason. Here, where he was doing the bulk of his work so that it would that word would spread, he had to be more careful. This is where there were Jews that would either persecute him, betray him to the Romans, or zealots who wanted him to be king and would, you know, gather up behind him. And so all three things would be bad right now. That's not what, it wasn't the right time for things to happen. So zealots want to proclaim him king, set him up on a physical throne. Jews wanted to persecute him. And there were Romans, you know, you had to be careful of them, whatever. So he said, let's just keep this between us. Now, you know, there's a multitude outside, and all those people that said, no, we're pretty sure she's dead, saw that she came out alive. So, you know, he tried to tamp it down. He tried to contain it, and that's likely the reason, that it just wasn't time for those things to happen. It wasn't time for the Romans to pick him up. It wasn't time for certainly not his kingdom to be set up. So he asked them not to mention some of these healings and some of these other miracles. He was still trying to get the word out, the gospel out. He still had this message he wanted to get out, and these other distractions could hurt getting it. The miracles were a side thing to the gospel of the kingdom. So we continue with the next verse and see the end of his long and very amazing day. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. Then he went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath had come, so this would have been the next day, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things, and what wisdom is this which is given him, that such mighty works are performed by his hands? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James, Joseph, and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? So they were offended at him. So we know that was Nazareth. He had left Capernaum, gone up the hill to spend the Sabbath in his hometown. So again, all these things kind of point to the events of this day happening in Capernaum. So it's not a long distance to Nazareth. He grew up there, and obviously this is where he ended up for the Sabbath. So let's look back on this one day. This one day in the life and in the ministry of Jesus Christ. It was a big day. It was a big day. The previous day was so exhausting that he fell asleep in a boat on a lake during a big storm. So in this 24-hour period, Jesus quieted the sea and the storm, the wind. He cast out 2,000 demons, or thereabouts. I'm not sure how many demons can possess an individual pig, but you know, there were 2,000 pigs, so there had to be, I would think, at least 2,000 demons. Cast out 2,000 demons from a possessed man. He healed the woman with the issue of blood for 12 years just by walking by, being there. And he brought a young girl back to life who had died. One day in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Not bad for a day's work. And we've just looked at this one day. One day of his ministry. If every day was as busy and productive as this day, it's no wonder John wrote in John 21, and there also are also so many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. That's how he closed out the Gospel of John. And of course, that's an exaggeration for effect, but wow, John had followed him around 3.5 years. He had seen probably more than one day like this. More than one day like this. How many days did Jesus spend like this over the course of 3.5 years? At the beginning of this message, I asked you to imagine a man. Did you imagine this man? I think you eventually got there, probably ahead of when I said. He was a man on a mission. He had work to do. He was dedicated to that work. Working some days, all day, all night, from morning till night, into the night. We focus today on just one of those days. He performed 4 major miracles that day. He undoubtedly taught many lessons that day as well, because he would patiently stop and say, with kindness and love in his heart, you know, who touched me? No, she's going to be fine. Do you, you know, believe she's going to be fine? He undoubtedly taught many lessons because that was his main goal, to teach the gospel of the kingdom of God, to not just walk around as a sideshow, healing people, fixing crooked arms and legs and giving sight. Those were a means to an end. The end was his main goal, teaching. He was not there to lead a rebellion against Rome. He was there to lead a rebellion against Satan. He was there to lead mankind to the kingdom, the real kingdom, the only everlasting kingdom, the kingdom of God. He was patient and kind. He was full of compassion. He crossed the sea through the night to cast demons out of a Gentile man. Then he got back in the boat and went back. He paused to show love and compassion to a woman who had suffered for 12 years and was already healed. He raised a young girl from the dead, presented her back to her father and mother, told them to get her something to eat, and his message grew. His attention grew. And you can bet the Via Maris was hot with the information of that day. Multitudes followed him to see what he would do, and some believed. This is our Savior. He was on a mission. He fulfilled that mission. Because of his efforts and sacrifices, and I would think most days, most of those days were like this, and full of sacrifice, full of personal sacrifice. But because of that, and of course the big sacrifice of his life, we have been saved from our sins. What a wonderful day this was. So many lives touched, so many lives changed. Let's hope they took note of his message as well. We conclude with that question that the disciples ask after he calmed the wind and the waves. Back in Mark 4, verse 41, and they feared exceedingly and said to one another, who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? This is Jesus, the Son of the living God, our elder brother, our soon coming King and Savior, and that was just one day.